Thanks for listening to this Eastlake podcast. Everything we do is supported by the generous donations of our local and online community. If you love what Eastlake is up to, we'd encourage you to contribute by visiting eastlakecc.com. We hope you enjoy this week's message.
Hey, everyone. I'm really excited to be with you today. Excited to speak today, especially because it's first time in the new digs. It's the second because I actually did the first service, so it's old news now. But I want to say thanks for hanging with us today. If this is your first time or you've been coming here for a while, just thanks for taking a little time out to be with us. Now, if you've never met, my name is Jason. I've been a part of this community for about 10 years. I used to be on staff and now am finishing up my probationary year with Bellevue Fire as a firefighter. And so trying to get that taken care of, wrapped up. But recently I've been reading a bit and having some conversations and a few things been banging around in my brain. And so just going to share some of those things. And my hope is that journeying with me today, they'll be beneficial for you. So there's this old quote by Archimedes. When I say Archimedes, you might be thinking sort of the stone. It's like the little owl guy. But in real life, he was like a brilliant scientist, a profound intellect. And he said, "Give me a place to stand, and I shall move the earth." And if there's anybody in here who's like an architect or they're a really brilliant math whiz, they're going to go, "That has to do with the lever." And I know that, the discovery of the lever. But it also has to do and is commonly referenced in regards to the nature of man. And I like this quote because it says something about the needs of man and the capability of mankind when that particular need is met. And that need, that first need, right, is a place to stand, somewhere sturdy, from which you can do and man can do unbelievable acts of good. In fact, if the quote is to be believed, we can move the earth. Now, when we talk about spirituality, and that's what I want to talk about today, your unique individual spirituality, your particular interpretation of religion, holy texts, life, death, family, love, miracles, that whatever this is for you, that I want to talk about what it should ultimately do for you. And the first and foremost thing that I believe it should do is give you a firm and solid place to stand. That is to say that what your spirituality should be doing for you is it should place you upon solid ground, which you might be enabled to move the earth. Now, there's a sister scripture in the book of Matthew. In the Bible, there's these books known as the Gospels, and they're kind of these recountings of the life of Christ. And in the book of Matthew, it says this, "Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain descended and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell. And great was its fall." Now, the important thing to note here, or at least the thing that jumps out to me, is the reality that both parties hear what is being said. They both comprehend and understand the wisdom that lies therein, but only one of the groups embodies that wisdom. And the first thing we note is that it says, right, that their house is built on rock. And what is meant by their house, right? Their life, right? Their reality, their lived experience. Or as Archimedes says, right, they have found a place to stand, right? Their house is on a solid ground, right? Their life is upon something solid. And next we note the rain, the storms, the coming winds, right? The storms of life is what that represents. And what this scripture seems to claim is that in the abiding of this wisdom, we are capable of enduring these storms. Because healthy spirituality has almost nothing to do with avoiding the storms and the difficult seasons of life. and almost everything to do with being capable of actually enduring them. The heartbreak, the disappointments, and the heartache of this reality. So today, what I'd like to spend some of our time doing is talking about how we as a diverse people with diverse perspectives find our own unique places upon which we will stand. And the second thing I want to speak about is how we as a diverse people with diverse perspectives will do our greatest work in the world and move the earth. Now, if you've been coming to Eastlake for any manner of time, or if this is your first time, you will soon come to find out that this is a place of unbelievably diverse perspectives. In fact, Brian McLaren, who's coming next week, this is kind of great because he is an individual who has a very diverse perspective from what would be the norm. And this wonderfully diverse group of teachers that are a part here and the voices that are a part of this community, they're primarily in the pursuit of aiding you in your journey towards solid ground for yourself, in your own life and in your own spirituality, from which you can do your own greatest work. Now, this is not really normative if you were to like look out at the broader world of religion, or if you were to look at Christendom or the world of Christianity. What's commonly propagated and proselytized is this idea of uniformity of thought. That the uniformity of thought, that if everybody can believe and cop to the same ideas and worldview, then we'll be able to create the same kind of person. And in true, in some respects, there are these fundamental virtues that lie inside Christianity, which are kind of do that, right? Like love, patience, peace, kindness, etc. These things do tend to produce a uniform outcome. But belief in things like doctrine or miracles or the various creeds of our faith, I don't think uniformity of belief actually in these areas creates uniformity of person or uniformity of deed. And this is why I like this quote so much, because it acknowledges that before we are able to move the earth, before we as individuals are able to do anything benevolent in this world, we first and foremost need a solid place from which to stand. We must find a solid place, or maybe an easier way of understanding it is we must find a set of operative beliefs. Now, my granny is 94 years old, and she's a Southern woman. She's from Mississippi, and she has an eighth grade education. And she believes in what I refer to as the classic kit, which is Christ lived and died and rose from death and paid for her sins through his death. And when she dies, she will go to heaven where she will be with Jesus and all the people she's ever loved and her ancestors. Christ is the Son of God and is divine and performed all noted miracles in the scriptures as they are declared. Now, many of you might look at my granny and you might think her idea is simple or brutal or small or Pollyanna. And maybe they are. Maybe they're even wrong. You know, I don't know. It's totally possible. But my biggest question when I look at my granny is and her beliefs is, what have they produced? What have her ideas, when embodied by her, not by everyone, has her worldview, her operative belief, when embodied by her, what has it produced? And it would be hard, and it would take a vast quantity of time for me to express all the beauty that she has imparted in this world and that she has been to so many people that are her family and not her family alike. Because the truth is when I look out at the world of spirituality, I'm an outcomes guy. I like to look at the long game of what the point of it is. And not outcomes in the sense of, did you believe the right thing or do the right thing so then you get the right result, but can you do the right thing when the right thing needs doing, regardless of the result? You see, what would be nice to believe and what we'd like to believe is that if you can get squared away on all the right thoughts, that you'll have all the right actions. But what we know is that modern-day heroes and the modern-day sheroes of our era really don't have uniformity of thought on much of anything. Martin Luther King, Abraham Lincoln, Maya Angelou, Pope Francis, Nelson Mandela, Thomas Aquinas, Martin Luther and Tupac Shakur are all followers of the Jesus way. But their operative beliefs are almost entirely different. How and in what way their faith operates and what they choose to stand on is terribly different. But the beauty and the truth and the hope that all of these people have been able to provide in the world is rather uniform. There are more divisions than these, right? There's the Orthodox, and there's the more conservative or fundamentalist perceptions of Christianity. There are the mystics, and now there are the progressives, and they've cut out their corner too. And in truth, I don't have time to name all the vast little divisions that lie inside this spirituality, but I hope by naming a few, you begin to see a pattern, that all of these men and women have a place, that they uniquely stand upon themselves, and all of them have been capable of moving the earth in ways that we would recognize as beautiful and loving. And I know you're probably thinking, Tupac Shakur, really? Don't sweat me on Tupac, or we'll be here all day. So then what can we gather from this, right? That firstly, you are unique. Your experience with God is unique. Or as Bishop Spong likes to say, I don't believe that any man knows God. All I believe is that man knows what he uniquely experiences. And I'm imploring you, I'm saying to you that, and what I think Archimedes is trying to say, is that you would sink deeply into those thoughts, those beliefs, and those experiences which give you a firm and a strong place to stand, that you might be enabled to do your greatest works. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The Matrix. It's got like Keanu and they like plug him into a computer and then he can like do all this kung fu and whatever. That's a really bad description. But the point is like it's a movie that basically postulates the idea that what reality is, how we experience it here, is nothing more than a simulation. And this is actually a really old idea. It's even in like Hindi philosophy. They call it Maya, the idea that what we're experiencing is an illusion. Or if you were to look at Einstein, he'll say that reality is most certainly an illusion, but it's a very persistent one, right? Now, this is a possibility. These groups could be right. They may be right. And maybe for them it's kind of like, well, you know, I think I'm hacking the system when I'm being all loving and I'm whatever, I don't know. But for me, that set of beliefs, if I was to operate from that position, me uniquely, I'm not condemning or speaking against that notion, but for me uniquely, I wouldn't be capable of enduring the hard seasons of my life. And it would not enable me to perform great acts of love at the sacrifice of myself or be and live as a person of hope. For me, the story that since I was a young boy has been my operative belief for the way I move in the world comes from the last speech Martin Luther King ever gave when he was alive. Actually, he gave it, then about a week later, he's assassinated. But I remember being a boy when I watched it. And ever since that day, it's forever been what's at the center of how I move through the world. And so it's like a 45-minute speech, so we're just going to watch like a quick 2-minute part of it, but check it out.
What will happen now? We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you. But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
So I love that speech. Every time I watch it, just I always get teary-eyed, and it always blows my mind, the depth of courage, and such a voice of hope, and also, too, just the awareness of what was coming for him, but the endeavor to still be about doing the right thing and going after what I see as the right outcome. So I've tried to think some of the new thoughts. My point is I've tried to think some of the new thoughts. I try to listen to everything, to actually be open to having, I mean, that's really listening if you didn't know. True listening, at least from my perspective, is you got to be open enough so that if someone says a thing, you're open enough that it could change your mind. If you're not open enough to have your mind changed, then you're probably plotting on what's your clever little retort that you're going to dice them with when they finish rambling. But I do. I listen to all that stuff. I read all the stuff. And a lot of it I've integrated into my personal beliefs, my operative beliefs. And in truth, it has benefited me. Some of the new things that have come into my spirituality and into my operative beliefs. But for me, there'll always be a deep part that will believe in the mountaintop, whether it is real or not, that will believe in the promised land, and that will believe in the old Negro spiritual that we shall overcome, and that through the love of God and the work of the Holy Spirit and the deed of our hands, we will escort into this reality the kingdom of God. Now, many people on this staff and in this community would probably not see it exactly the same way as me. They would not see it the same way as King. That is to say that they have uniquely found their own set of operative beliefs that enable them to do their greatest work. And this is why Eastlake exists, that through the diverse teachings and voices of this community, you might piece together some operative beliefs. I went on a trip recently to California to visit a good friend, and on this trip, we had numerous conversations about God, the afterlife, spirituality, the works. And I realized that we all kind of hold something differently from that allows us to operate. And yet all of us were open to one another, laughing, relating, connecting, and being moved by one another's beliefs. I left that environment feeling like I had teammates and allies, not enemies and strangers. And some of my friends don't believe in the afterlife. And so the gravity of the finality of this life lights them on fire and leads them to acts of great deeds, because this is all they'll ever be. And so it makes kissing their kids goodnight and eating that prime rib dip and hanging out with your friends and laughing critically important. For others of mine, it's the recognition that there is an eternal life that will be spent with their families and loved ones. And so they recognize that the sufferings that lie in other families here on this earth is a problem. And so they work as benevolent forces, recognizing that all what lies in wait, but to be a beneficial presence to other people because of that lovely gift. And then I have other people and friends that believe that life is a gift. And so out of that very basic and simple gratitude, they just try to be a gift to other people. So step one of what I'm trying to encourage you to do, especially if you're part of this community, is to find your place, to not feel bad about where you land, to acknowledge that all beliefs are really kind of only as valuable as they are operative. And so whatever comes here, as C.S. Lewis once said, and it stuck with me forever, is whatever helps you on your journey, you pick it up. And what doesn't help you, you leave it where it lays. And that seems fine with me. Some people, again, won't agree with that. But I would encourage you not to abandon us, because we need you in the mix. We need that diversity, because you need Augustine as much as you need King. You know, I think that. I think you need that diversity. I think it makes the world strong. And I think it helps people find where they uniquely fit so they can do their unique goodness in the world. Now, the second part is the business of moving the earth, the challenging business. Now, for me, life is a working life. It's about work, a work of love, a work of hope, a work of kindness and sacrifice, a work of peace. And I always loved what Jesus' brother James, he says that a faith without works is dead. And that is to say that that which gives your faith life, right, is the works you do with it. That which you are able to operate in is what gives your faith a sense of life. And I don't know, maybe you've heard this story. It's an old Greek myth. It's about a guy named Sisyphus. And Sisyphus is a guy that is a really rebellious soul. He's very hard-headed. And the gods curse Sisyphus with this task of pushing this giant stone up this monstrous hill. But he thinks that he's eventually going to push this stone over the top of the hill. And that's what they've told him. You push it over the top of the hill, you're set free, you'll be as a god. But he doesn't know that the gods have basically tricked him. The stone grows ever increasingly heavy as he pushes it. He will never be able to push the stone over the top of the hill. And that's his curse. And the gods think they've won. They think they've been clever in their punishment. But a great thinker named Albert Camus, I don't know if you've heard of this guy, he says that we would think of Sisyphus, we must think of him as being happy. Because Sisyphus, in pushing the rock to the top, that moment of despair when he realizes, I will not reach the crest, and the stone rolls back down to the bottom, is the very moment that Sisyphus also gets to partake in hope. Because he understands what his duty is, what his job is. And so he's able to return to the bottom and go, maybe this time I pull it off. Because he's unaware. He's unaware of whatever trap lies. All he can do is push the dang stone. So all he knows is, okay, not this time, but I'm going to take 5 minutes, get a drink of water, and maybe this time we get the stone over the hill. And so the stone becomes his. It's no longer the gods. It's his tool by which he suffers and learns, and his body grows strong, and his mind grows durable, and his will and his ability to move forward, they are upheld by this suffering and by this task. And so his life has immense purpose and immense meaning. And that's the great folly in the God's trick. And we humans are caught in this cycle of work and futility and hope. Martin didn't defeat racism, and Mother Teresa did not stop the suffering and dying of innocent young children. And Christ did not defeat Rome or fix human beings from doing the wrong things sometimes. But yet we would all look at their lives and go, yeah, but they won, right? Yeah, I don't look at Mother Teresa and be like, you know, she lost, you know? I don't look at Martin and go like, he just didn't pull it off. You know what I mean? And why is that? Because we're Sisyphusian at heart. We love the pushing of the stone. We love the hopefulness that it is to try to roll it over the top. I like to think we think we're great if we can, like, you know, finish every task and we just get A pluses on all our tests. But the true sensation of joy that comes in this life is that striving struggle. We are a striving creature so far. Maybe we'll evolve to something else down the road, and this will be completely BS nonsense by then. But right now, this seems to be the case, that we have battles to fight, and commonly they're cyclical, and we fight them over and over again, so that we can experience hope, so that we can grow, so that we can be changed by those efforts. There's a great, not a great, but there's this guy. It's funny, now when I tell you the story, you're going to be like, that's weird. But there's this guy who's an offensive tackle for the Kansas City Chiefs. His name is John Wellborn. And he's a super sharp guy. And he talks about life and reality in a way that's always really made sense to me. And again, I think it comes back to this whole working thing. This idea that suffering and that life and that work and that, you know, even lifting weights, getting strong, is like a giant pile of dirt. And what your job is you're trying to move the dirt from one place to the next. You're trying to grow stronger, right? So what is the process by which you do that? Well, you move a little dirt every day. And some days, man, you're ripping and you got a shovel. And you're just cruising and you're filling the wheelbarrow and you're just moving dirt. And then there's some days where you just have a teaspoon and you're only able to make the trip once. But that the point is that you keep moving the dirt. That you keep getting up and moving the dirt. And sometimes the universe gives you a hand. And sometimes it gives you a Christ. And Christ is like a backhoe and he just goes, and just can take a whole bunch and put it somewhere, right? Or Martin shows up and he can take a whole bunch and put it somewhere. And we start to really feel like we're making headway. But I think we've lived on this earth long enough to know that there's dirt that keeps adding, right? The dirt keeps adding, there keeps being more suffering, right? As we solve problems, more problems arise. And you even hear Christ say, right, you will have trouble in this world. again, a Sisyphean reality. The dirt's going to always be there, and you are always going to have to move the dirt. But I love moving the dirt, personally, in my own life, in my own marriage, my own relationships, and in the world at large. It's what gives my life meaning and purpose. I think for most of us, it's that way. It's why we work hard at our jobs and love our kids and try in our marriages, because we're aware it's what gives it meaning. A little bit of the dog fight is good for us. And so I appreciate when people come around and they go, "Hey, Jay, how you doing? Good to see you, man." But I prefer someone would just go like, "Dude, did you move your dirt this week?" You know what I mean? Like, or are you mailing it in? You know what I mean? I would actually benefit from that, that accountability. But I hope that that kind of illustrates one of the tricky things we're caught in when it comes to work and how it's so tied to the meaning of our life. And the reason why I do the work I do, because I do lots of other things outside of ESLIC, where I serve with at-risk youth, and then in particular like homeless families and kids, and then we do a couple other things. And it's primarily because what I want to experience in reality, I feel quite often that what I have to do is put it into the world. So if I want to experience hope, I have to go be hope to somebody, and then quite often that sense of hope is returned for me. There's a nonprofit called 2 Feet Project that a buddy of mine started, and I've been basically being a part of this since the start financially, but only recently have I started within the last year, really kind of like giving my time and showing up for these boys at this at-risk youth home. Because I just started feeling like there wasn't any hope, and I'm like, well, I'm gonna go and just try to go be a kind, loving presence to someone, to these young men. And what was so cool is to, one, watch their transformation over the year. And then this year, it was rad at the thing they both got. Two of these young men got awarded academic scholarships, and they're crushing it, man. They're just crushing it. And immediately, I was overwhelmed with the sense of hope because I'd been a part of it, because I'd done something with my body. And very quickly, I realized, like, I was looking for hope, and so I thought, like, maybe if I get around, you know, a hopeful environment. But really what it was the actions that I partook in that helped to create that sense of hope. And so I just hope that you're seeing that at some level, right, what we want out of this world, we so often are going to have to participate in. It's one thing to hear a message of hope from a stage, and it gives you a warm, fuzzy feeling. But to have that long, enduring hope, right, that solid place from which you can weather the storms, that requires, I think, some efforts with your body. And so in the end, the whole point of that quote, the part that sticks out to me the most and why I care about it so much, is because I've always been on the look for the highest tiered belief. I was that kid where, like, I don't know if you probably know someone like this, or maybe you're like me, where you go to do something the first time and you can't just like do the half version of it. You have to have the best of everything before you start your endeavor. So it's like, I want to be a snowboarder and I'm 14. I can't just do the sensible thing of renting the snowboard and, you know, whatever. I have to have the sickest snowboard and the newest gear with the raddest helmet so that when I eat crap 50 times, I at least look good while I'm doing it, right? Or you play golf and you think, what's going to make me great is the $5,000 set of golf clubs, but you know Tiger Woods could whoop your ass with your granddaddy's busted clubs in the garage, right? But you're not aware of that. And so I do that a lot with things in life, and in some ways it served me well. But the big thing is that when it comes to belief, for me, I've always looked for the highest tier in the sense of, what do I think does the best and greatest work? And one of the things that I stand on, and that I think Christ is such a tremendous picture of, is the self-transcendence. Ryan says this a lot. He said it to me a number of times, but it's the ability of Christ to transcend the sense of his own well-being in life, the need for him to uniquely survive and have things go his way. You see it with King, which means that it's not something you can't get to as a regular person if Christ is divine. Clearly, it can be achieved by a regular human being, which means that it's a profound challenge, that the highest tier is when you get to the place, not where all of a sudden you look out and you go like, well, I have my kids and you have your kids. And for me, there's a buddy of mine, and he says like, hey, I love everybody, man. I totally do. But like, if an earthquake comes, tough luck. I'm just grabbing my kids and I'm bolt, right? And I love his honesty, because I think it helps to really speak to us in our own hearts about the ways in which we are so concerned with our own self, our own survival, our own well-being. But the thing you see with Christ is not this kind of devaluing of his family and his children, but the elevation of other people around him, other children and other lives, to the same level of his family. The inability to lose anyone. The inability to not fight for the cause of anyone. And that is something worth dying for. It's certainly worth something worth living for. And I think it's a tremendously strong place to stand. It's also terribly difficult. And I think when we hear Jesus say things like, you lose your life to gain it, we know what he's saying. The idea that everything that we have in our life that generates a sense of comfort and well-being, they aren't necessarily bad. But if they so impede you that you so prize your life over another's, it becomes problematic. It might make you feel good, but I'm not certain, again, with the outcome, I'm not certain it's going to enable you to do your best work. I had this, two other little quick stories and we'll get up out of here. I remember when we adopted my youngest sister, Haley. She's from China. And I was really concerned because I was like, I love my sister, we're super tight. And I was like, I didn't know if I would have space in my heart from a person who's not of my family, not of my culture, not of my race, from a different part of the world. And Callie just saw her coming up the escalator and Callie burst into tears. And I was a little more standoffish. But then they put her like in my arms and immediately I was like, oh, welcome to that level, right? Forever now, you're here with me. And that sense immediately illuminated that what causes me the sense of distance and to prize my family over others is the lack of connection that I have with other people. As you generate a connection, they will elevate in status and importance and require what you need in terms of what you may need to do for them or what role you may need to serve them, especially if you're concerned with doing good things in the world. And there's a good quote by Brené Brown. I've always liked this. And because it says that people are hard to hate up close, so move in. And so that is to say that as you walk around here, I've been coming here for a long time, and I'm really horrible at this, so I'm going to start doing this now. Every weekend I show up here, I'm going to talk to someone I don't know. It's going to make me feel weird and awkward. But I know that the only way that I'm going to be able to look at this community with any more greater sense of value is if I establish more significant connections. And so I would ask you to do the same thing. That if you show up here every week, just say hey to one person you don't know. And, you know, hit them with the classic BS. What's going on, man? How's it going? You like the Hawks? Sweet deal. Hang out. If that's all you can do, eventually you're going to go like, I know that dude. I talked to him about the Hawks a week ago. That's eventually going to create a sense of deep meaning into your life. And it's going to create that real deep sense of connection. And from that place, I think we're going to be better at doing work. So the last thing I'm going to tell you, the last story I want to tell you is about The Sandlot. Have you ever seen this movie? Okay. Yeah. Squints Palidorus, Timmy and Tommy McTimmons, Porter, and Smalls. And Bane the Jet Rodriguez, don't forget him. I think there's like one other one I can't remember. But the thing is, but Smalls, right? And you know how this works. Smalls comes to play to a town. And he's a STEM kid, right? He's a science, technology, engineering, mathematics. He's that kid, okay? Nothing wrong with that kid, okay? Clearly right now we're benefiting from that kid. But the thing is, he's that kid, and he doesn't fit in. And the boys invite him to come play baseball. And I love that when he shows up, he's just got like the busted gear and the really awful hat, and he can't even throw a baseball but 20 feet, okay? And everybody laughs at Smalls. And the common phrase, right, we use, he was used in the English vernacular of, you're killing me, Smalls. It's such a common thing. That's how real that is, that character. But one of the kids, especially, and it's important to note that he is the best at baseball, takes his time to go over to Smalls, and he says, hey, tomorrow before we come play at the park, come to my house. And so Smalls stops by, and he gives him his old LA Dodgers hat, and he gives him a baseball mitt. And he says that the way you throw a baseball is when your arm gets to here, I want you to just let go. And we'll just see what happens. And they get to the field, and the kids are like, this kid again? You brought Smalls? This is like going to be the worst. And a guy cranks one off into outfield, and he picks it up, and he says, hey, you know, throw it back. And he just does what Benny said, and the ball soars, and it hits the pitcher. And everybody goes, all right, we're going to play baseball. We're playing baseball now. And what I'm saying is that what Eastlake is, it tries to be, is the Benny the Jet. And we try to teach people how to play the game. And everybody plays it a little bit differently, right? Michael Jordan shoots like this. Larry Bird shoots like that, right? Steph Curry shoots from his chest. But they all make threes. And that's the point, to teach people how they uniquely play the game, how you uniquely play the game. So will you please stand with me? It's just important to remember that all Picasso needed was a paintbrush, and all Scorsese needs is a camera, and all Einstein needed was a chalkboard, and all Jordan needed was a ball court, all the Wright brothers needed was the sky, all Christ needed was an open heart. All you gotta do is use the tools you have. Wherever you are and the uniqueness that you are, use it. Stand somewhere and move something. That's the point of this talk, is I hope you find a place where you are strong, where you can stand, and once you find it, I hope you move and do something good upon this earth. Thank you for your time, and thanks for listening.